Quite a few of the Proverbs tend to be self-explanatory. Of course, a number of them say the same thing in a little different way. So we may scan across some of them without stopping to comment on every one in detail, because otherwise we'd never finish the book. So when you have that many tidbits all thrown in together, why, you can't spend a lot of time on each one individually. Chapter 11, the false balance is abomination to the Eternal, but a just weight is His delight. Of course, that's putting it in modern English. The actual Hebrew terms say balances of deceit are an abomination. But a perfect stone is His delight. So back in those days, before they had metal weights, they'd measure by fairness of stones, and having a fair stone and not a polished stone or an iron rock or something that was different in weight from the accepted scale. Of course, what he's saying there is that a man should get his money's worth. You shouldn't sell something where you don't get what you think you're getting, what you see in a package or what you see in a box, and then it's half empty. Or so any kind of trickery or injustice or unfairness or a lack of equity is an abomination to God. But He delights when people are honest. You know, we literally had years ago a couple of men making a car deal, and the guy said, "Well, I'll give you so much for that car." And he said, "No, I didn't really worth that much." He said, "Well, it's worth that much to me." And he said, "Well, I'm not going to take that much for it." And he said, "Well, I'm not going to give you less for it." And so, you know, they almost got into a hassle about being fair and being sure it was just. But I've never forgotten that in 28 years, but that verse illustrates that. Now, in verse 2, when pride comes, then comes shame. But with the lowly is wisdom. Of course, psychologists would never agree that there's ever any time to be lowly. If you heard Mr. Scotch's sermon in the auditorium a couple of weeks ago, you know he was showing how many men in the Bible had a self-abasement and a humility, and compared that with what psychologists say. You know, that if you have a low self-esteem or a low self-image, then you're mentally off and you're mentally sick. But that depends on whether you have God's Spirit and the truth of God to take the place of your own self-confidence. So if you have a godly confidence, you've got the soundest mind there is. But as sure as you get puffed up and cocky and a banty rooster and strutting around, you might as well look ahead, because down the road, shame's going to come your way. Either from a know-it-all attitude or a nobody can show me anything or teach me anything attitude, and you're going to learn the hard way and you're headed for shame. So anytime you catch yourself getting conceited or proud or cocky or puffed up or swell-headed, or thousands of proverbs we have described that, then you ought to grab yourself and say, watch out, you know, you're headed, shame's ahead. But if you have a lowly, humble, meek attitude, then that's wisdom, because then you can be warned and you'll listen and you can seek counsel and receive it, and you don't have to learn the hard way. The integrity of the upright shall guide them, but the perverseness of transgressors. So you notice what begins to happen to you when you begin to do what you know you shouldn't do, and you step across laws that say don't do this, or do this, and you ignore them, and you step across those laws, it builds in you a perverseness. And that'll end up destroying you if you keep building that kind of an attitude of doing what you know you shouldn't, not doing what you know you should. And so it develops a nature about you. I remember years ago, Dr. Hayes' brother up in Santa Rosa, California, had a saying that he had out, and he said, You sow a thought, you reap an act. And you sow an act, and you reap a habit. And you sow a habit, and you reap a character. And you sow a character, and you reap a destiny. And it just showed how it all starts off with that one little thought. So that's what he's saying here. What happens to someone when they continually do what they shouldn't do and don't do what they should do? Well, it develops a perverseness of nature in you. And you keep that growing, and it'll destroy you. Now, a dollar bill sign after verse 4, riches profit not in the day of wrath. Now, that may be the day of God's wrath. You know, you could apply that to the Great Tribulation. All the wealth that exists won't do you any good in the day of the Great Tribulation. Or in the time of Job's whirlwind, you know, you could add all the money there was and it wouldn't have gotten you out of the trouble. If you lived up at Mount St. Helens, all the riches in the world aren't going to profit you when that volcano starts belching out the smoke and gas and lava. So, regardless of how you apply that, riches don't deliver you when an invader comes or when calamities of nature, but righteousness delivers from death. You can look back, and that happened with Sodom and Gomorrah, and that happened with the flood, and that happened in 69 A.D. when the church fled out. So righteousness delivers from death. By the way, that's a Petra promise, that God's going to spare the righteous when he pours out death on a city or a country or anything else. Now, quite a few scriptures he elaborates on righteousness. The righteousness of the perfect, the mature Christian, not perfect in modern English, but shall direct his way. So that's saying in a little different words what verse 3 said. The upright is guided by his integrity. Things come up by having had an honest past and a truthful past. He reacts that way. His habit and character would direct him that way. So the same way with the righteousness of the perfect. As long as you're living by all of God's commandments, which is righteousness, then they direct your way. But the wicked is going to fall by his own wickedness. Then he goes on, the righteousness of the upright shall deliver them. Similar to what he said up in verse 4, deliver from death. But transgressors, going back to what he started out warning you about, shall be taken in their own naughtiness. So by transgressing, you finally build up in your nature a wickedness. The word naughtiness is a bad translation. It really means wicked or evil or corrupt. When a wicked man dies, his expectation shall perish. He just lived for this life. He just lived for materialism and power and influence and possessions. And so, that's all it was. That's the end of his expectation. That someone, the hope of unjust men, perishes. So he's contrasting what will happen with the righteous. They'll be born of God, and be spirit beings, and live forever, and be delivered out of death, and everything else. But the wicked, they're just people who live for this life and this life only. The righteous is delivered out of trouble. The wicked comes in his stead. A hypocrite, there again, that isn't the regular word for hypocrite, but just means a profane or godless man. With his mouth, destroys his neighbor. Doesn't have any moral restraints of slander or false witness or lying or whatever. If there's no God, then there aren't any guidelines about how to use your mouth. So if you're godless or profane, with your mouth you can destroy your neighbor. Now, that doesn't ring with our satanic proverb about sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never harm me. It's really a weird proverb.
through
knowledge shall the just be delivered. Now, just, again, has to do with fairness and equity and balance. Doesn't have to do necessarily with morality in the sense of love or things like that, but being just. So you have to know when you're being just. And God's judgments tell you what is justice and when you're being just. When it goes well with the righteous, the city rejoices. People aren't in fear or horror or dread. When the righteous are rulers, or when the righteous are owning businesses, and when righteousness is in, then there's a happy city. And when the wicked perish, they're shouting. The oppressors, and the crooks, and the violent. When those people are removed from a country or a city, then they're shouting and rejoicing. You can look through the examples of Kings and Chronicles and Judges. By the blessing of the upright, in other words, because God does pour a blessing on the upright, the city is improved. It's wealthier. It's more prestigious. It's respected. But it's overthrown by the mouth of the wicked. So after a contrast of what happens in society in general as to whether the mass of the people are righteous or wicked and whether the leaders are righteous or wicked. Now he goes on then, and he that's void of wisdom, and here the word wisdom has to do with heart. He that's destitute of heart, doesn't have the character, doesn't have self-control or will. He that's destitute of heart despises his neighbor. But a man of understanding holds his peace. So if you don't have much character, and somebody says something about you, or insults you, or puts you down, then you may despise your neighbor. Think lowly of him. But if you're a man of understanding, you don't have your feelings on your cuff lines. You don't have that attitude of retaliate. If people speak badly of you, then you just say, well, big deal, so what's that got to do with anything? Swear it or slough it off or pass it on. A man of understanding holds his peace. A talebearer reveals secrets. Now, you may want to put some symbol for tongue. I've got a T out by 9 and 11 and 13, because these are some of the scriptures dealing with the use of the tongue. A talebearer reveals secrets. But he that's of a faithful spirit conceals the matter. Someone that has God's spirit will always think, well, what good can I do by saying something about someone? What good will it do me to tell Betty Jones about Mary Brown or something? You know? Or what good is it going to do me to... So you're always in control of your tongue and your thinking that way. So if you're of a faithful spirit, you conceal the matter. But just the opposite, you're a talebearer, revealing secrets. Where no counsel is, the people fall. What chance have you got of not making a mistake? If you go off on your own thinking and your own judgment without anybody else's counsel on. So where no counsel is, the people fall. I've seen that happen many a time, whether it has to do with relocating or changing a job or getting married or whatever. Where there's no counsel, the people fall. But in the multitude of counsel, there's safety. Now you can misapply that scripture and say, well, I went to see Hartnell's Brown minister, and he didn't give me a very positive answer, so I'll go see Bill Smith minister. You know, a few years ago, someone said, well, I need to counsel with someone while I'm out here. And they said, well, who should I counsel with? And they said, well, that depends on what kind of an answer you want. That's not what that proverb means. In that kind of multitude of counselors, you're going to get in trouble. You're just seeking your own answer. This is a scripture that you probably can learn from to establish the advisory council of elders. He's always sought counsel. He always had counsel from his wife, counsel from other headquarters men. He that is surety for a stranger. But you notice again, it doesn't say surety for a brother. He that is surety for a stranger, a neighbor, notice how many other ways we've read it, shall smart for it. Be sore over it. He's going to hurt by it. He's going to worry over it. You'll never know whether the guy is going to lose his job and disappear or what. So it's never smart to be sure. You can be a good neighbor and a good friend without being sure. But further, it's a different story. He that hates suretyship is sure. Say, he's not putting his life in some other person's hands as to whether he has a good financial record or a bad one. A gracious woman retains honor. You know, when it says Christ grew in the grace and knowledge, we should grow in the grace and knowledge. That's an undeserving attitude, an attitude of meekness and humility. Who am I, you know? Why am I called? Why did God allow me to be in the church? So a gracious woman is just the opposite of the loud and forward one we read of or back in earlier chapter. This is a woman that's humble and meek and doesn't have that self-sufficient attitude or righteous attitude or proud attitude. A gracious woman retains honor. Strong men retain riches. Now the word retain there is actually, it not only means keeps it when you get it, but it's the word that means seizes, grasps, holds fast. So a woman that's a gracious woman grasps honor. They demand it or command it. They seize it by their graciousness. That's the same way strong men grasp and seize riches. The merciful man does good to his own soul, but he that's cruel troubles his own flesh. Now, there again, when Jesus said, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us, Jesus said, what judgment you judge, you'll be judged. That's what he's saying here. If you're a person who shows plenty of mercy, then you're doing good to your own soul. Later you're going to be shown plenty of mercy. But if you're cruel, the opposite of full of mercy, then instead of doing good, you're going to trouble your own soul. You can't have that attitude like Job had of spirit of judgment, spirit of haughtiness and superiority, and even if you're righteous, it still doesn't benefit the neighbor. The wicked works a deceitful work, but the hand that sows righteousness shall be a sure reward. You just go out living by all of God's commandments and you're sowing a sure reward. But if you're always thinking about getting and tricking and deceiving and gaining the benefit on every trade or every bargain, the wicked works a deceitful work. That's just his habit, his attitude and nature. As righteousness tends to life, who pursues evil pursues it to his own death. It's addictive. You get caught up in it, and you can't just turn it off and stop it. Same way, righteousness builds and grows and develops. And you get more and more life. The more of God's laws you know, and the more of them you live by, then the more life you gain. Moses said, he that does them shall live in them, you find out the truth. They that are of a forward heart And there again, that doesn't mean what we think in modern English, but it means perverse. They that are of a corrupt or perverse heart, they're an abomination to the Eternal. So when the very depth of your being is perverse, the very guts of the inner man, the heart, when they become perverse, then that's an abomination to the Eternal. That's almost impossible to change. But such as are upright in their way, they're again dealing with just. They're honest in their dealings. They're outgoing and concerned for the other person, not always trying to get the best of the other person. Such as are upright in their way are His delight. God looks down on men and sees someone just always trying to be upright and just and fair and always trying to be equitable according to God's laws, then God takes delight in them. Verse 21. I've got kiss written across this verse because it promises you what's going to happen to your offspring, your children and grandchildren. Though hand joined in hand, the wicked shall not be unpunished. You can have a monopoly or a grouping together of people. You can have more and more and more people going the way of wickedness. But that's not going to keep God from punishing the wicked. And the seed of the righteous is still going to be delivered, no matter how many enemies or how much opposition joins against them. You get the 10 nations of Europe joined against Israel, and God's people are still going to be delivered out of it. No matter how massive in numbers, the wicked joining hand in hand out to hurt the righteous, they're going to get punished, and God will deliver the righteous and their seed. So in a sense, that's a promise your kids will go with you to the place of deliverance when the wicked join hand in hand to cause trouble. Verse 22, as a jewel of gold in a swine's snout. Now, they always put rings in a swine's nose to keep them from digging under a fence. So, he's also picturing here a jewel of gold that the ladies would wear in their nose as a part of jewelry, decoration. So he's contrasting that to putting a gold ring in a swine's snout. That's the way a fair woman, beautiful, sexy, whatever you want to term the attractive woman by air of culture and flair of dress or shape or beauty of face, a woman like that without discretion. And the word suggests more that the woman has departed from discretion. Not that she's just without it. She had it. She was going the right way. She was taught. She was perhaps one of God's ladies that He's called, and they're departing from that way, the discretion. Now, some proverbs are easy to memorize. You know, that one's very easy. Every time you see pigs, I always think about that proverb. You know, that you see pigs rooting around, trying to root out under a fence, and you think, yeah, just put a gold ring in that snout, and that's the way a sexy, beautiful woman is who's departing from discretion. See, you hide those scriptures in your heart, and that'll keep you from sinning against God. Some woman like that comes along sometime and you'll say, yeah, all right, watch out. You better remember that gold ring in the swine's snout. The old saying, no, beauty is only skin deep, but ugliness is to the bone. That's a... We won't run across that one in here, but... Maybe we should start us with chapter 32 add some in that way. But okay, going on there then, in verse 23, the desire of the righteous is only good. In other words, once you get your nature attuned to God's law, then you don't even desire to always go the wrong way. You're not always battling yourself every day because with all of your being you want to go the wrong way and you're pulling the reins. No, 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 you know, stay in the right way every day, every day, every day. Now, if that's the case, you've never been converted, you know. You need to get baptized for the first time. The desire of the righteous is only good. Now, that doesn't mean he doesn't get snared and tripped up. You know, Galatians 6 words that in a good way because it says, even if a brother is overtaken in a fault. See, that's how it describes it. Even if a brother is overtaken in a fault. It's not that he just every day wanted to go that way and desired to go that way and just fought himself every day with that desire to go the wrong way. That's just, the desire of the righteous is only good. If you're going the way of wickedness, then it's finally going to get so much that you just might as well expect wrath because you're used to it. You get whacked because you're wicked and wrath comes because you're wicked and then finally, that's all you can expect. Now, verse 24 and 25 are twin scriptures that relate to dollars. So we got the dollar bill sign across the next two. There is that scatters and yet increases. And there is that withholds more than is meat, but it tends to poverty. Well, you know, that's an odd law that some people can just seem to be giving to everybody and anybody, give you the shirt off their back. And yet, somehow they still seem to have more coming. And yet there are others that have that penny pincher stingy attitude. Well, I'd like to help you, but I can't. They'd always like to help everybody, but they never can, and they're always hanging on to what they have, thinking they'll build up a reserve or build up an amount, and that never works. That's why God's law is so simple. If you won't give $10 out of $100, you wouldn't give $10,000 out of $100,000. You might think you would, but you wouldn't. So if you don't scatter what you do have, then you certainly aren't going to scatter if God gave you a million. You know, just the opposite is true. The more money you get, the more you feel less secure than you think you need more to be secure, and you get more, and you know, it's just an unbelievable law. But there are people that scatter, and yet they increase. And there are others that sit on what they have and store it away and penny pinch and always have good intentions, but it always tends to poverty. The liberal soul, the soul of blessing, actually it says in Hebrew, the soul of blessing shall be made fat. Of course, that means choice. It doesn't mean fat lover or fat meat or something, you know, that's not desirable. Or the soul of blessing shall end up with the best, end up with the choice. And he that waters shall be watered also himself. So when you think of other people in need, it's like you're watering grass or trees or shrubs that are in need. And then when you water, then later when you have that trouble, then you get watered. You know, Mr. Armstrong's likened the third tithe to a pump primer. Maybe that's like what he's saying here. Someone that does water, then later when they have a need, then they'll be watered. What if you're one of those skin flint penny pinchers that would never help anybody with anything, that tended to poverty, then you know you didn't do any watering, so later when you need to be watered, people are going to say, well, yeah, remember that tithe one? Remember what a skin flint that penny pincher was. Now, the next verse is actually similar to the previous two. Here again, you might note the word soul in that verse 25, because it has to do with the way you, your attitude toward your finances. That's your soul. A liberal soul. Now, verse 26, he that withholds corn, the people shall curse him. The blessing shall be upon the head of him himself. So if you have a question as to whether it's a godly principle to store up for a better price while people are starving to death, dump beets and dump corn and dump wheat and dump things because you don't want the world price to go down. So people starve and you dump it to get more out of what you're selling. That is one of the most despicable abominations God must have ever seen. There's no way you can keep from really get angry at that. And that's why God puts it the way he does here. The people shall curse him. The blessings are on the head of someone that sells it as the need is there and sells it as God produces it. He that diligently seeks good procures favor. But he that seeks mischief, you don't have to seek very hard for that. It's going to come quickly. But you've got to diligently seek good in order to gain favor. To seek mischief, the slightest, and it's going to come on you. You know, Mr. Armstrong says, Satan's broadcasting. You have to shut it out or it automatically comes on you. But God's Spirit, you have to draw on. You have to work with and increase it. Study and pray and fast and meditate and build it and develop it. It doesn't just come automatically. Satan's Spirit just comes automatically. No effort at all. It's there. You don't do something against it, it's there. Another dollar bill, verse 28. He that trusts in his riches. So after God tells you that you can increase by scattering and by not being a man that hoards up things in time of famine or scarcity, but now if you begin to trust in your riches, you're going to fall. Mr. Armstrong mentioned years ago that when people are able to enjoy the nice things, it should be like a nice motel room. You enjoy it to peace. That's the way your home is. That's the way your car is. That's the way your possessions are. You enjoy them while you're there, but you don't set your heart on them. They're not your life. They're not your trust. So if you have confidence in your riches, then you're headed for a fall. You watch and see if that's an unwritten rule or an invisible rule. God might bless you and you'll have a nice car and a nice home and a nice job, and then you begin to get confidence in those things and settle into them and get caught up in them, and then all of a sudden away you go. I've seen that happen a lot of times even as a minister, where you get your home and your library and you get everything all set up just perfectly after you're in an area 5 or 6 or 7 years, and just as sure as you finally get it where it's just all right, sat, there you go, you get transferred, you know. So I don't ever unpack all the boxes anymore, just leave some of them there. But as sure as you ever trust in your riches, you're headed for a fall. But the righteous shall flourish as a leaf. Really, it is not branch, but a leaf. Green and bright and life-giving. He that troubles his own house, that can either be by drunkenness or unwise management. That can be by being a dictator or being a wishy-washy dish rag instead of a man. He that troubles his own house shall inherit the wind. Now think about Job. Job inherited the wind. And how did he do it? He troubled his own house. Because look at his kids. They couldn't stand their dad, you know. They couldn't wait to get away from their dad. What about his wife? She despised him. And yet he got them all kinds of things, you know. They were wealthy, and they were famous, but he was self-righteous. And God never did say he was righteous. So it doesn't make any difference how it is that you trouble your house. You're going to inherit the wind. Look at King Saul. He troubled his house, and what did he get? Yet David didn't. Yet David was a man of great battles with his nature. God can tolerate that a lot better than he can ill intent and self-righteousness and hypocrisy. So regardless of how you do it, any man that troubles his own house, or any woman, doesn't have to be a man, shall inherit the wind. And the fool is going to end up in the end, being servant to the wise of heart. And we can, again, look at this building behind us that Mr. Armstrong acquired, and the man that had it before ended up being servant to the man that was wise of heart, and he built it all and had all the money for it. Now, verse 30, the fruit of the righteous is family and his wife and his children and his respect and his job, and all of those are fruit. The fruit of the righteous is a tree of life. And he that wins souls, now that really sounds good, you know. The Baptists memorize that verse right and left. He that wins souls, and yet, let me read out of a good Protestant commentary what he has to admit. And it's kind of funny to read, because they hate to admit it, and they'd rather not admit it, and yet, if they'll be honest, they have to admit it. So after he makes some comments here, he says, there does not seem any ground for seeing in these words the meaning which winning souls for God or Christ has gained in Christian language. There doesn't seem any ground for seeing in those words that meaning. They signify about what we mean by winning the heart. Someone sees the way you live and you win their heart. They just really respect you and like you, and they'd like to be with you and like to be like you. And so he that's wise draws the souls, the affections, the confidence of men to himself. The wise man is the true conqueror. The same phrase in the Hebrew, win souls, in some other places is translated, takes the life. 1 Kings 19 and verse 4. Psalm 31 and verse 13. Daniel 12 and verse 3. 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 19. Or James 5 and verse 20. Now, if you get those down, you'll have a good answer for Protestants that will take you to task on that verse. If you corral them sometime, I think we were being a little smart-aleck in doing so, but we went down on the street down in Colorado when we were students, and here were these people trying to win souls. Brother, are you saved? Well, saved from what? You look around like, what have I got to be saved from? You know, like the car's running down on you or something's dropping on you. Are you saved, brother? Say, well, saved from what? Say, well, I mean, have you saved your soul? Well, where is it? I didn't even know I had one saved. Well, you know, you got to save your soul. It's going to hell. Well, you just act dumb and ask dumb questions and you don't have any answers, you know. But then they'll finally get you to scripture like this and say, well, don't you know God's word says he that wins souls is wise? Sure enough. That means, by your example, you may make others want to be like you or have what you have. Or we win souls at feast sites all the time, you know. Or at the Dells than anywhere I've ever been, because we've seen people there hugging people after the feast when they leave with tears rolling down their cheeks. Because they hate to see those people go. We've won souls during the feast, yet didn't make a single member out of it. Well, going on, verse 31, behold, the righteous shall be recompensed in the earth. Except 144,000, they get to go to heaven. That's what the JW say, no? The righteous shall be recompensed in the earth. Now, the Adventists just say, well, that means you just have a better life while you're on the earth before you get to go to heaven. There's always an out. God didn't write the scriptures where you can't get around. No, the whole reward of the righteous is right here on the earth, much more the wicked and the sinner. So if God is going to recompense the righteous on the earth, then the wicked and the sinner are going to get recompensed too, in a lake of fire that's going to burn them up. Now, chapter 12, whoso loves instruction, and there the word is more discipline. It's not one of the words for understanding or wisdom. Whoever loves character, discipline. It's not the word for heart, though, but more for will and Whoso loves discipline loves knowledge. But he that hates reproof is brutish. That'd be like a jackass that's about to go off a cliff, and you're trying to turn him and whip him to get him to go the right direction, and he just objects to your whip and is determined to go right on, off the cliff he goes, you know. Well, he that hates reproof is like a brute, like an unreasonable animal, like an animal with instinct that can't be changed, because what he does by instinct and not thinking. And yet that's the way we become. If we become people that won't listen, that can never be told, that can never be corrected. And but if you love discipline, then you love knowledge. Now, a good man obtains favor of the eternal. But a man of wicked devices is going to be condemned. Here again, he's talking about a man that's fair and honest and just. God rains favor down upon him, but if you're tricky and a shyster and a crook and a corrupt, then you're going to be condemned. A man shall not be established by wickedness, but the root of the righteous shall not be moved. So there's a stability and a permanency and a security about being righteous. The roots are stable and strong and deep and sound, but no wicked are that way. Their lives are very unpredictable, very insecure, and very changeable. And a virtuous woman, same word as Proverbs 31, a virtuous woman is a crown to her husband. Now, virtuous really means not so much just moral as it does a strong woman. A real Christian woman is a crown to her husband. But she that makes ashamed has rottenness in his bones. Now, that may suggest adultery or harlotry. It isn't the normal word for those, but it could be included in that. She that makes ashamed by laziness or by materialism, you know, there are a lot of ways any woman that's opposite the virtuous woman makes ashamed. Her husband has need of spoil, or her children aren't well taken care of, or she doesn't open her hand wide to the poor, or she doesn't consider feeling by it, or she doesn't open her mouth with the words of wisdom. So any of the traits that are opposite the virtuous woman makes ashamed, and that'll be, you know, if a man has a wife that's his own partner forever, that has offspring by, and she's lazy or materialistic or too high society, and that will be like rottenness in his bones, like cancer, where the bone marrow doesn't produce the red blood cells and maintain strength and life there. The thoughts of the righteous are right. So, the more you get wrapped up in God's laws, then the more even your thoughts are right. You're not even thinking wrong all the time, or wanting to do wrong all the time. So those are scriptures that really show what conversion is. We're sinners even when we're converted, but we're not always thinking crooked and cheat and lie and sin and covet and murder, and the thoughts of the righteous are right. They may not always do right, but the counsels of the wicked are deceived. Can't help themselves. It just builds in their nature. The words of the wicked, taking right on from where he left off there with counsels of the wicked, and even the words of the wicked are to lie in wait for blood. Take advantage of somebody, rob someone, cheat someone, lie to someone, fraud someone. So all of their words even lying in wait for blood, but the mouth of the upright shall deliver them. So instead of your mouth always getting you into trouble, if you're upright, then your mouth gets you out of trouble. It spares you from trouble. It keeps you away from deception and trouble. The wicked are overthrown, and they are not. They're gone. They disappear. But the house of the righteous shall stand. So there again, like with verse 3, giving you that stability and that trunk of the tree, deep-rooted, sound, stable permanency. But not like the wicked, they're overthrown and are gone. Just like a wind comes and blows and they're gone. But that isn't the way the house of the righteous is. It isn't overthrown. It isn't. They don't reap the wind. It's permanent and secure. A man shall be commended according to his wisdom, but he that is of a perverse heart, that same froward, shall be despised. Now, it even shows you that humans respect other humans that are just and kind and sincere. But if you have a perverse, crooked heart, then you're going to be despised. People just can't stand someone that's crafty and tricky and dishonest. He that's despised, now this is a different word. This word despised means lightly esteemed or lowly. One of the lower class, he that's looked on as one of the lower class and has a servant is better than he that honors himself and lacks bread. Now, what he's saying here in the Hebrew is not that a man is lowly or lightly esteemed and still has a servant, but a man that's lowly and lightly esteemed and is his own servant is better than someone that's puts on the big shot show, puts on the royalty image, puts on the highbrow, sophisticated, important outward appearance, and lacks bread. So even if you're a lower class person and have to work for yourself, you're better than someone that professes greatness and lacks bread. A righteous man regards the soul of his beast. Now, there, notice, naphesh. Back in Genesis, the first chapter, that word naphesh is used 4 times of animals before it is ever used of man. And of course, the number 4 is the number of God revealing himself. So if you want to know what God has to say about the soul, you know, I was reading a book the other night about the soul, and the early Christians did not believe in the immortality of the soul. It was a couple of hundred years before any Christians ever believed in immortal souls. It's one of these days we're going to finally dig up all the history of the first few centuries, and it's going to be dumbfounding. Because nobody ever questioned the doctrine of the millennium up until about 300 and something A.D. Even all those Catholic guys believed in the millennium. For several hundred years. You can't find anybody disagreeing with the millennium for several hundred years. If that's not what you hear. Well, 4 times in Genesis, God talks about the critters as souls before he ever uses it of man. So a righteous man regards the soul of his beast. So a guy that blows his top and beats his cow isn't righteous. You ever notice back there when the servant went to get a wife for Isaac, and when he arrived, he said, take care of my animals, and then she said, let me draw some water for you. But they always looked after their animal, you know. It may seem to be a little thing, but it shows your heart. You know, a man can claim all kind of righteousness, but if he'd beat a poor, helpless animal, then how much of a heart could he have? A righteous man regards the life of his beast. He doesn't load his little burrow down with 300-pound bags. He doesn't work his animal to death and work him on the Sabbath. You know, the Sabbath was made for asses, horses. The Sabbath was made for animals like that. It wasn't made for chickens. Dummies lay eggs all week long, you know, Sabbath included. Sabbath was made for horses, though, and donkeys, but it wasn't made for chickens. Sabbath, well, depends on cows, you know. In Big Sandy, they adjusted the feet of the animals where they milked them before sundown Friday and after sundown Saturday and never milked them on the Sabbath. A lot of people tell you can't do that, but they ran a test for a number of months or a few years and found out they got more milk, and it was richer milk, and it was higher quality milk, and the cow lived longer and was healthier because they made it keep the Sabbath. Well, I don't know whether you can do that with chickens or not. But you know, it says, a righteous man regards the soul of his beast. But the tender mercies, even what someone who's wicked might consider tender mercies, even the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel. So you can really think you're being tender when you're... You know, I read some of the... Well, I couldn't say I read some of them. I read all the divorce and remarriage cases. I can read cases where somebody probably thinks they were being tender toward their wife. And boy, am I in judgment. You know, they just speak them lightly, or they just abuse them lightly, or they badmouth them lightly. Well, that's not being tender. But the tender mercies of the wicked, even their tender mercies are cruel. But what about a righteous man? What if his tender mercy isn't shown toward an animal? Then his tender mercies are cruel too. Now, that doesn't mean we ought to all go around and have bumper stickers, "This car stops for animals." You know, and you kill 10 people behind you stopping for an animal on the road. People go to extremes. But verse 11, he that tills his land shall be satisfied with bread. But he that follows vain persons is void of understanding. Now there again, the word vain doesn't mean, it just means an inactive person. It can mean lazy, it can mean pleasure mad, it can mean, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean vain in the sense of cocky and banty rooster type. Idle persons, lazy persons. The wicked desires the net of evil men. In other words, he wants to get what other crooks are getting. He wants to get the end result of what other wicked people gain by their wickedness. But the root of the righteous yields fruit. So there again, it just shows the contrast of permanency and stability and foundation and pillar compared to material things. The wicked desires the net, whatever he took in the net, whether it's fish or rabbit or whatever it is. The wicked wants the fruit of what he sees other men get that are evil, yet he doesn't see what comes along with it. The wicked is snared by the transgression of his lips, but the just shall come out of trouble. Doesn't always say you won't get into it, but you'll always come out of it if you're just. So that has to do again with fairness and not morality necessarily, except that part of morality. But it shows how wickedness starts by transgressing with your lips. So, well, I probably shouldn't do this, but a man shall be satisfied with good by the fruit of his mouth. And when you give someone wise counsel, when you're able to cheer someone up or guide someone to avoid a problem by your counsel, then there's something about a man's nature that is satisfied. He feels successful, accomplished, happy. I know many times in the ministry, at the end of a long Sabbath day, you'd say, well, you know, you just can't do much more in one day. You just can't feel any better. There's no way you can feel more satisfied and rewarded and more accomplished, or like those hours were well spent. So that's the way a man is with the fruit of his mouth. And the recompense of a man's hands shall be reckoned to him. So if you work, you'll benefit from it. If you have the energy and do things, then you'll gain from it. The way of a fool is right in his own eyes. So there's another kind of a fool, someone that you can't ever tell anything. You'll never make them see their way is going to be bad or hurtful or wrong. So if you run into somebody that their way is always right in their own eyes, then they're a fool. One of the kinds of fools. You know, you can be a fool a lot of ways. He that hearkens to counsel is wise. So several scriptures through here about counseling. Now, if a person is a know-it-all and doesn't ask for counsel, then you may have to suffer. A fool's wrath is presently known. Now, the word presently in the Hebrew literally means in that very day. A fool can't endure a put-down even for that very day. A fool can't put up with any kind of injustice or bad words against him. Or, you see people that will fight at the drop of a hat. You just even suggest that they might have made a mistake or might have been wrong, and they've got their fist up. They're ready to fight. And they're just another kind of a fool. So, if somebody can ignore an insult, what good does it do to contend when you're insulted? You know, what if somebody says something bad about you, or puts you down, or lies about you, or, you know, what good does it do to answer back, or argue about it, or let your displeasure be known? And yet, you say, well, you can't call me that. You can't say that about me. No, I have my rights. Who do you think you are? So we Americans, you know, we have our rights. We're going to stand up for our rights. Well, that the Bible condemns that. God says a wise man ignores an insult. The prudent man covers shame. But not a fool. Boy, his vexation is known immediately. That very day, his vexation is known. I've seen those chip on the shoulder people who want to fight. And verse 17, he that speaks truth shows forth righteousness. The more you talk about God's laws, you're speaking truth. God's laws and truth are one and the same. But a false witness, he shows forth deceit. There again, a good one for the tongue. Verse 18 is another one on the tongue. There is that speaks like the piercings of a sword. Well, we've got phrases for that, you know. People that dig and cut you down and slur and sarcastic, negativisms, put-downs. Our world seems to be saturated with that in the end time. There is that speaks like the piercings of a sword, but not the tongue of the wise. If you have any wisdom, your tongue is positive. It's producing happiness and health and prosperity, you know. A lot of people have been taught from the time they're young, if you can't say anything good about somebody, don't say anything at all. The tongue of the wise is health. The lip of truth shall be established forever. But a lying tongue is but for a moment. Sooner or later it gets caught up with, and people don't trust it, and people don't like to be around a liar. But if you have a lip of truth, then there's stability, establishment. People stay around you. They enjoy you. They trust you. That's established forever. Deceit is in the heart of them that imagine evil. But to the counselors of peace is joy. Again and again, these same areas repeated. You have wise counsel and avoiding fighting and trouble, and you're a counselor of peace, then you'll have joy by your counsel you give. There shall no evil happen to the just, but the wicked shall be filled with mischief, calamity. The wicked's life, it's just in one bind out of another one. but, you know, all things work together for good to those who love God. There's no evil. God can turn it around. God can benefit you by it. Lying lips are abomination to the eternal. They that deal truly. So primarily this lying lips are talking here about crafty trade and opposite of dealing truly. The prudent man conceals knowledge. Now that used to always be a puzzle to me, and I never did figure that one out for years. I thought, well, why would that be? Looks to me like if a man is prudent, then he ought to want to be passing that around, letting everybody benefit from it. I remember one time I asked Dr. Hasson things personally, and he was telling me a lot of things. I said, how come you don't tell everybody about this? And he said, well, you know, the Bible says a wise man conceals his knowledge. And that just left me empty. You know, I couldn't figure that out. I didn't know what he's talking about. And really, the only way I can understand that is that if you find somebody that's always talking and always knows everything about everything, you're just not going to go with them. They can't know everything about everything. There isn't anybody that knows everything about everything. So somebody that's always blabbing, we already read, didn't we, about in multitude of words there lacks not sin? So there's another proverb similar to that that says, a wise man is like the deep well, and someone that has understanding will draw him out. Why would you ever have to draw somebody out if they got prudence? They ought to want to give it out. They ought to want to just flood you with it and unload it on you all the time. That isn't what it says. It says if you have understanding, you have to go to the man that's wise and draw it out of him. So I guess he's just saying there that if somebody's always an authority and always talking about everything, then you're not going to go to that guy. I don't notice anybody going to Job asking Job anything. Did you ever read about anybody that went to Job to ask him anything? Nobody goes to know-it-all. Nobody goes to feel secure around someone that's self-righteous. You always feel in fear. You always feel like an ant crawling up to the master, you know? Well, the prudent man conceals knowledge, but the heart of fools proclaims foolishness. There again, you just know a tree by the fruit it bears. When you hear speech, you can tell what's in the heart of people by the speech. If they're proclaiming foolishness, then there's the heart of the fool. Yeah, another dollar bill, verse 24. The hand of the diligent shall bear rule, but the slothful shall be under tribute. There again, the same word for deceit that we've been going through all the way through here, deceit. It's not really talking here about sloth in this case. The deceitful are going to be under tribute, like an army invading, taking a country under its power and levying taxes on it. They're under tribute. That's the way someone is that's deceitful. Sooner or later, it catches up with them and they end up paying for it. With hard work, just plain old diligence. You know, there's no substitute for hard work. If people never learn to enjoy their work, they're never going to be happy, because half your lifetime is in work, half your waking hours. Verse 25, heaviness is in the heart. Heaviness in the heart of man makes it stoop. So people can get weighted down with burdens and trials and pressures and fears and worries. And now, righteous people are to help bear the burdens, to lift the heavinesses from the heart of the men that are stooped. And we all have those kind of days, you know. You really can't hide that kind of a thing as much as you might think you can. A good word makes it glad. Just a bit of a positive input, a bit of a encouragement. You know, we always say every day, well, have a good day, have a good day, you know. That isn't what he's talking about here. Here he's talking about hearty counsel, or someone that can share a person's burden, bear you one another's burdens. conscience and so fulfill the law of Christ, Galatians 6 says. So if you come along with an encouragement, or maybe when you greet someone, instead of saying howdy, or you saying hello or something, you say, well, how's everything going? How's life treating? You could say like the French do, how do you carry yourself today? Comment allez-vous? Or comment vous portez-vous? You know, how do you carry yourself today? How are you going today? Crooked or straight? Or a good word makes it glad. The righteous is more excellent than his neighbor. Not fair then. He's not more righteous. The righteous, someone that goes by all of God's commandments, is going to be more abundant. The word excellent should be here. His life is more full, more abundant. He has a brighter perspective and countenance. The way of the wicked seduces. So the more you read here about the way of the wicked, it really gets to you. It makes you realize you've been taken, you know, and you get in the habit. You get it in your nature, and you can't get it out. It's running you down to destruction. And so it really frightens you about letting yourself become wicked. You notice it's always wicked all the way through here. He doesn't use any of those other words about trespasser or missing the mark. Or only saw that once. All the others, sinner in verse 31. But all the rest of them are wicked. The way of the wicked seduces them. Even they're trapped and tricked and caught. The slothful man, now this is a three-toed animal that was moped around like a slow bear. The slothful man roasts not that which he took in hunting. So here again, you've got a dollar bill verse that shows the attitude some people have. They don't take good care of what they have. They don't even use up all that they could use up that they could have. So even when they go hunting or fishing, they're too lazy to clean it, throw it back, or leave it dead out in the woods. So if you are that way, then you're slothful. You don't roast that which you take in hunting. And then notice in this case, the second explanation of that first statement, the substance of a diligent man is precious. He's not wasted. He doesn't have full garbage cans week after week after week.